Well, not 100% right. They recognize them, but, you know, they're not from our...
Bombers, one of the bombers is the same one that blew up a bus in Israel.
Yeah? Oh, okay. All right. Anyway, to continue with where we are.
We're studying tomorrow. We're studying.
Why is it making so much noise? Okay. All right. We are continuing right now on Megillah, Daf Ches Amud Beis over here. We're still trying to finish this business about leprosy. Okay. So, my favorite talking number to you. Okay. Elo Amarava Mehocha. So Rava now says, no, I'll give you a different verse to explain. Right. It's written, V'yatsa ruah shebo hanega. So, it's written concerning a person who has leprosy, and he has, all right, he has leprosy in him, shebo hanega. So, misha tzerato teluya begufo, yotza zeh shein tzerato teluya begufo, so it says. In other words, we have to see that there is a difference between a leper whose leprosy is dependent upon the leprosy observed in his flesh, right, as compared to the person who has leprosy only because he's suspected of it, right, and therefore all that he has to do, what, is to count days, because, you know, there's a question as to whether he is or he isn't, okay?
Is such a thing as having leprosy just in the air and the garments? Not having leprosy in
well,
the skin,
there's a right. Actually, there's a section that deals with leprosy in the garment, leprosy in the house. Right. Yeah. To understand this, you really have to read again Tazri and Mitzora very, very carefully. Right. So it's not dependent, he says, you know, upon a sign of leprosy, but just when he has to do what? He has to count 7 days. Because of the suspicion that he might. So, Omalei Abayi, by the way, I just want to point out, the first time that the king comes, if he determines that the spot that he sees is not leprous, then that's it, the guy is clean. You understand? But it's up to the Kohen to determine. It's when the Kohen is not sure whether the guy is clean, you understand? But it might be leprosy, that's when he has to quarantine him, and he has to count 7 days, and then the coin comes back again to see. Okay.
He insists on carrying counting 7 days, even if he cleaned before 7 days?
If the coin determines right to begin with that the guy is not suffering from leprosy, he's clean, that's all.
Okay.
Yeah. But the counting of the 7 days is because the kohen may feel, you know, that the guy might possibly be suffering from leprosy.
Out, yeah.
Right. But if at the end of the 7 days he's convinced that the guy is suffering from leprosy, then already he says that's begufo. In other words, we can see physically, you know, that he's suffering from leprosy. Omalei Abayi, so Abayi said to him, Ela miyato, you're arguing with one pasuk, I'll give you another pasuk. He says, Kol yimei asha nega bo yitmor. It's written that as long, all the days, literally, in which the guy has leprosy, he is tameh. So in other words, misha tzarato tluya begufo. That also proves the same point that you made, but I have a better pasuk, okay? That proves, he says, that leprosy, where leprosy is the... dependent, well, he's saying this is an argument, but right? An argument. We might make the following argument, he says, that if a person has leprosy which depends upon his body, in other words, as we said, you know, the person whom it is confirmed that he is, then he is the person who has to be sent outside the camp, right? But we might say, right? But we might argue that if a person is only he's leprous, he's only considered a possible leper, but it's not confirmed, right? So that, as we said, he's the one who has to count the 7 days until the next visit of the Kohen. So we might argue, ain't to shiluach, right? He does not have to be sent outside the camp. So chitema ochinami, and if you say your taka, that's the way it is. The Hakatani, doesn't the Mishnah tell us what? Ein bein mitzora buskor and the mitzora muchlot, that there's no difference between the mitzora who has to count days. He's quarantined for 7 days, and the one who it's confirmed as a Metzora, Ela Priya Frima, except for Priya Ufrima, right? In other words, letting the hair grow and letting the garments, you know, be rent. But when it comes either to the fact that he has to be sent outside the camp, or that if he comes, for example, into a house, he makes that house tome, in this case, it applies to either of them. So Amalei, you may. So he says, hey, wait a minute. The Torah says, you may. Call you may. Why does it say call you may? It's the Ravos Mitzora Muskor, the Shiluach. That's, in other words, I come to the same conclusion, but I don't like your pasuk. I like my pasuk better. My pasuk says you may. That is, we might argue you may. That would make a distinction, but if it says call you may, then in that case, the Ravos Mitzora Muskor, then that includes also what the person who is only quarantined for 7 days and the shidduch at the same time still has to leave the camp, right? So the argument might be hochi tiklachus siporim my tamo lo. So tell me, why shouldn't this guy that also have to shave himself and bring the sacrifice of birds? Why not? The katoni im bein tohor b'toch hezkir l'tor b'toch hachlot elo tiklas tziporim. This is what we learned in the Mishnah, that there is no difference between one who becomes clean, whether it is from simply the simple quarantining or from, you know, having been more confirmed as a leper, except this business of tiklachas and tziporim, you know, the shaving and the birds. So Abaye says, Amakra, I got a posik for you. What is the posik? Pasuk says, "V'yotza kohen amechutz l'machane, v'hine nirpo nega tzaraas." Said, written over there, that the kohen is to go outside the camp, in other words, to examine him, and behold, look, nirpo nega tzaraas. Right, the leprosy has been healed. Mi shetzarato t'loy b'refuas. Okay, so this applies to whom? In other words, that he has to shave and everything else. This applies only to one who has to be cured of definite leprosy, right? But Yotzazeh, however, the one who Shein Sarato Taluya Berefuas Hal Beyomim, that, you know, the one who is a Torah only for counting a certain number of days, yeah. So to him, this business about shaving and rendering the garments, this doesn't apply. Okay. All right, yes.
This is a, you know, this is a question on the ball from Sriya.
Right.
I have a couple of questions. From what we're reading now, is that we know that they were quarantined, since they had
right.
the in a place.
Yes.
And it was outside the
right.
So there was a special
Yeah, right. He undoubtedly had a little hut or a tent or something which he stayed, of course. Yeah.
And now, if they were quarantined, does that mean they had to stay in? I assume that's what quarantine is.
Right, right.
How did they eat? And did they get a chance
to bathe? Okay. Yeah. Okay. They were permitted to do those things, definitely. I mean, they could get food brought in. Let's say a person would bring food and leave it outside the tent, right? And then, you know, he would come out of his tent and he would get the food, the drink, whatever he had to do. Okay. Yeah, that he could do.
Does he contaminate utensils?
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Well, there may have been others, though. I mean, we don't read about a leper colony. This
I know,
is
but
right.
It's
yeah.
There's so many people. It's
possible, but I don't know. But we have no reference to a leper colony over there. Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah, of course they can bathe. But, you know, the question is, what do you bathe?
Because other
people,
right.
Whatever you
brought them could not be used.
Right, right. Okay. But as I say, there's no reason not to bring them. After all, they have to live also. So you have to give the means whereby they could do
leprosy
it.
Leprosy
okay.
wasn't a cure, really.
A real leprosy, you know, the problem is, again, we don't even really know what type of leprosy is that they were talking about over here.
Yeah.
Whether it's the same as what today medical science calls leprosy or not, it's a very different story.
It must
we
be
don't know.
Because of the whole symptomology.
Right, right. There's no question about that. All right, anyway, Baruch Hashem, we've finished this, and now we're ready to at least begin a new Mishnah for a few minutes. All right. We're still in the Ein Bains, but now we're no longer in that exotic territory of Ziva, Saras. Okay. We finally come now to something which is a little bit more applicable. Okay. All right. Now, Ein Bains Forum that Tfilin the Mezuzas Elish Hashem Nichtovin the Choloshein with Tfilin Mezuzas and the Nichtovis Ela Ashuris. Okay, so now we have to make very clear what do we mean by the terms that are being used over here. Okay. First of all, by the word Sefer, they don't mean a book. Yeah. Could be a Sefer Torah. Okay. Or, as we'll discover, it might possibly be any book of the Bible. It's also a safe. Okay?
Right.
Yeah, it could be any book of the Bible. This is what they're talking about over here. Okay? But it says there's no difference between this, you know, as we'll discover, you know, the writing of the Sefer Torah or the material that you use as compared to Tefillin and Mezuzahs. Except for one thing, they say. And we'll see, you know, that this is going to be a subject of dispute. Namely, Elish Hasfarim Nichtovim Becholoshim, according to the Mishnah over here, a Sefer Torah could be written in any language, whatever. This is what it says, right? And we'll see that they dispute that afterwards, okay, in the Gemara. But, I mean, right now the Mishnah says that. It can be written in any language. But with Tefillin and Mezuzos, they can only be written in what we call Ashuris. Now the question is, what is Ashuris? So the answer is, we have two different types of writing back 2,000 years ago. Okay? Now I'm talking about 2,000 years ago. I'm not talking about Rashi script. That's another way of writing, okay? Sometimes when I take a look at modern Israeli printed letters, it's hard to tell the difference what they are too. But that's because they have too many artists who are creating letters, okay? But getting back to 2,000 years ago, you had, first of all, what was called Ksav Ivri. It also has other... but what was that? This is the ancient alphabet which was used, and we find it, for example, on inscriptions, okay? And... these inscriptions, you know, are written in an alphabet which formed incidentally the basis of our own modern Goyish alphabet, okay? This is one where an aleph looked sort of like this, okay? And naturally when they made it straight, so this is how it became an aleph, okay? A base originally was supposed to look like a house, this is the way it looked, okay? And so that became, just that a little thingamajig, that that became a B, you understand? And a gimel was supposed to be like a camel, it looked like to somebody, right? So that was the gimel, and then as you can see, it became a gabba in Greek when they turned it around the other way, okay? Dalet, of course, looked like this, and so on. You got the idea? So this was the basis, actually, of the alphabet that they had, you know, and the Greeks took it over, they made modifications to it, as for example, instead of having it from right to left, they made it from left to right, okay? This is one of the modifications the Greeks did. And then when the Romans came along, they made a couple of more modifications.
Sumerian? Was it the Sumerian?
No. Phoenician, yes. Phoenician, yes. Canaanite language. Yeah, these were the letters that they used. All right. So, Gemara and Sanhedrin refers to this as Ksav Ivri, okay? Well, they also have other... Yes? Yeah, right. Okay. Bob looks on it. Bob looks like a hook, which is another meaning of the word Bob. Means a hook. Okay? All right. So, what are they saying over here? They say that the tefillin and the mezuzahs may not be written in that script, but instead, what do they have to be written in? They have to be in what we call Tzav Ashuri. In other words, the kind of letters that we have in front of us. Literally Assyrian, but maybe it means something else. But at any rate, it has to be written in the kind of letters that we have over here. Okay?
And that's what we use today.
Right, right.
Yeah. The original tablets had the which letters?
There's no what? What, in the ancient, you mean the Ksav Ivri? Yeah, yeah.
But the Greeks had
The Greeks did have round. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. I mean, I'd have to think around.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, actually, it's true. I mean, the iron looked like this. This is the way it looked. So certainly it was round. Because what is it supposed to look like? Like an eye. Okay? So that letter definitely is round. So that's why you can't make a statement to, you know, that... Alright, most of the others. Okay, alright. That I'll accept. But don't make a general statement. Okay? Blanket statement. You know, it's like Ain Bain, right? Yeah. Yes, 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 absolutely. You see on coins, for example.
Yeah.
Where, you know,
right. The ancient coins.
The Cheirut Yisrael. You see, it's written in the ancient, the old Ivri script. All right. So the point is that a Sefer Torah, according to this Mishnah, it would be all right to write it that way. But we'll see that the Gemara immediately is going to reject that idea. Okay?
When they found the scroll, what script were the scrolls?
Okay, the Dead Sea Scrolls.
When they come from a later time?
The Dead Sea Scrolls come approximately from 2,000 years ago. They used already this kind of writing. Yeah. You take a look at the Sefer Yeshayahu over there, for example, in the Scroll of Isaiah, where it's almost the complete text of Yeshayahu. So it's written in this kind of language. Of course, you have to be able to read some of it because the way they formed it is not exactly the way we form some of the words. Now, printing, you can have it like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if it's only in script, so then, you know, not everybody, even in English, I mean, does every person write exactly the same way? You see that there are differences.
Like when you do a Torah scroll.
Yeah.
It has to be absolutely
the same. So has to be absolutely
exactly.
Right. Right.
So what model are they using?
They are using another Sefer Torah as their model.
But even there, they are different types, depending where they were sitting there.
Yeah.
Slight different. As far as it's different, they might check as well.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the formational letters, but if you take a look, you see that it's the same letters, and yet, you know,
there are
little differences between them, right. Well, the crowns, that is already a different story. Right. Okay, let me just finish the Mishnah first over here. All right. So, according to the Mishnah then, tefillin and mezuzahs can only be written using the script that we are familiar with. Okay? Rabbi Shimon Leah Lo Mary says, Af b'sforim lo hitiru. He says, even in Sifrei Torah, they did not permit a person, you know, to write it in any language, right? Right? Lohitu, they did not permit it, Sheyakosu, that they should be written, Elo Yevonis, only Greek. Shimon Liel, okay. He loved the Greek language. Okay.
So he made this point. He passed this way?
Yeah. Well, he passed it. It doesn't mean that we accept it. But nevertheless, he felt, you know, that in Greek, there was justification. The justification we'll see is the famous story about King Ptolemy, he wanted to have a copy of the Torah written in Greek. So that's certainly a certain amount of sanctity then now adheres to the Greek language. Going up should be
complete. But except
okay.
The Sector of Kings, was it a translation or a transliteration?
No, it was a translation.
The Sefer Torah would not be a translation, but a
You write it in Greek, it would have to be a translation.
Like it would be in English.
Of course. Sure. Absolutely.
Write it in the characters of another language, but you still read it the way the Torah is written.
Okay. What you mentioned, reminds me of the fact, for example, Sadia Gaon, okay, he translated the Torah into Arabic. Mm-hmm. Okay. Of Sadia Gaon, one of the great scholars. But I took a look, and you know what? He used these letters for Arabic. Okay? Of course, you have a parallel then, with Yiddish. We write Yiddish also with this. I've also seen, for example, the Ladino. I've seen the Ladino language also written with Hebrew characters as well. It's Greek.
You're talking about the Ladino?
Also in Hebrew.
Correct, right. He wrote German in the Hebrew letters. Yeah, that's correct. Okay. All right, but at any rate, as we see, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, no, you cannot write the Torah in any language other than Greek. That's the only thing. Okay? But, so what do they have in common? So Gemara says, "Hold on, talk from the Gidin, or the Tami, so you don't have to show it." All right. The fact that the various sheets that you write upon have to be attached to the next one by means of sinews, which is the way you see the Sefer Torah, so that is alike, okay? And also the fact that the Tamis HaYadayim, which we learned already some time ago, means that if it's holy, treat it as holy and don't simply handle it with dirty hands or something like that. Whereas if it has no holiness, then you can do it. All right. In other words, the Tamis HaYadayim makes literally unclean. So
what is sinews? How do they do it with sinews?
From an animal.
Like lathing.
Yeah, right. You perforate it, and then you lace it. Exactly what is done, right. Okay. All right, so I think we'll stop at this particular point. Maybe I should go down. Yeah. I think I'll stop at this particular point tonight, and then we'll continue right from this point. Yeah, so the next 4 weeks are all Yontif. And we won't be able to meet, but I want to wish each and every one of you, I shall have Rob and Ruka, should have a good year, a sweet year, a healthy year, a year of peace, bracha, these are the things. Right.
We don't have a million.
Okay. We are now continuing. Tonight is the 17th of October, the year 2001, and the question has just been raised by Beverly. Beverly. Loud, so it can be recorded.
Dr. Miller, we're not the rabbis who formulated the Talmud, including Shimon ben Gamliel, indeed product of their time. And at that time, Greek was a worldwide, or as far as a language of the ancient world, all over the ancient world, of the educated classes. And couldn't you now say that that was the way that the thinking or the way that this particular thought was derived, the Greek, that the Torah could be translated in Greek, wouldn't it be appropriate to change that language as times changed and other languages predominated in the world as it became fully and among the liberal classes?
Okay. Oh, yes, a loaded question over there. All right. First of all, remember what we're talking about. We are talking about actually writing a Sefer Torah with all the sanctity of a Sefer Torah, except that this time, instead of writing it in Hebrew, the Hebrew text, what they have is the Greek text, which is written like a Sefer Torah, right? And according to this opinion, then, such a text would be a valid Sefer Torah, even though it was written in Greek and not written in Hebrew. Okay?
We're talking about a translation into the Greek
A
language,
translation into Greek, Greek, right, language. But to be considered with the same sanctity and that has the sanctity of a Sefer Torah.
We know that when we see a translation and the many kinds of translations we have in English, that we have a problem since it is not an exact translation of the Torah itself.
Correct.
So would that not apply as far as Greek is concerned? How could they get...
Okay. You're jumping ahead of the gun slightly because as soon as we go into the second, next piece of paper that I will distribute to you, the text that we have on the next page, we'll see that that is a very practical problem that faced the translators of the Bible, the translators of the Torah, I have to be specific in this case, translators of the Torah into Greek. And I'll talk about that as the text also talks about it, and I'll make my own comments on that, okay? All right. Now, to get back to your question, Beverly, it doesn't mean, therefore, that any other language other than Hebrew has carte blanche in order to write a Sefer Torah in that particular language, at the, give it the same sanctity that a Sefer Torah would have. Okay? You understand? I don't have to tell you that a Bible which is printed in English, assuming it doesn't have the New Testament in it, as the missionaries are wont to give us, right? All right. But if we're only of, you know, our Tanakh, okay, that it has sanctity, but you cannot compare the sanctity of a printed book with the sanctity of a Sefer Torah, you understand? So that he only gave permission to have a Sefer Torah written in Greek, but not in any other language, okay? Now, you're right in the fact that in those days, Greek was used as a language, particularly in the entire Mediterranean, the Eastern Mediterranean region, where actually it competed with the Aramaic language, okay, which was also prevalent in that area. But Greek was used, you know, by people who had, I mean, they would talk Aramaic, let's say, to each other commonly, but when they had to talk to government officials, they would talk to them either in Greek or in Latin, okay? But the influence of Greek culture was such that even among the higher classes in Rome, they liked to use Greek, just as, you know, there was a time when educated classes in this country were talking French because it was considered high class, okay? So, when I studied Cicero ages and ages ago, Cicero's letters, not his orations, but Cicero's letters, when he writes, you know, to this one, that one, the other one, and so on, from time to time he'll go into a Greek word, okay? Because he figures, oh, this word really expresses it. But, you know, we do the same in the English language. We have a word, pride, but, you know, it's fancier to say what? Hubris. You've seen, you know, suffering from too much hubris and so forth. So what's hubris? Because the answer is it's pride. It's a Greek word for it. Okay.
Pride is a Greek word.
Yeah, yeah, it's a Greek word. Yeah.
Even Russia goes and borrows old French and gives it to countries, right?
Yeah, yeah. There was a time in Russia, in the days of the Tsar, when you were not considered an educated person unless you actually spoke French. I remember looking through, I mean, I'm no Russian scholar, so I looked through the War beginning of the War and Peace, right? Miri Voina. And there was French all over. Because, you know, the aristocrats were talking French to each other, right?
Question.
Yeah.
Is there any difference between a translation into a language or into hiding the Chumash with the group, with the sound of the Hebrew, but in the... characters, let's say the three characters, like Mendelssohn.
Transliteration.
No, no, no. I understand what you're saying. In other words, what you say, Bereshis, and spell it out, Beta, Epsilon, etc., etc.
That's called translation.
Yeah. Because there is a mission in Shabbos that if you save a Torah burns, you're allowed to save it. No matter in which language. No, which does it apply to?
Okay. The reason being, I mean, that after all, if it contains the word of God, no matter what language it is, it has a certain sanctity. But it doesn't have exactly the same sanctity that the real Kisvei HaKodesh has. Okay, that's the difference. Okay, all right.
A brief question.
Yeah.
Does the word God in English, three letters, have any sanctity?
No. There's a difference of opinion about that. Needless to say, we should treat it with respect. So I write G-D. I mean, that's what I write. Okay. But some people, you know, they say that it's not the same. It's long that the Shemus Hagdoshim, you know, real Shemus, have to be written in Hebrew. So if it's not really written in Hebrew, then in that case it doesn't have the same sanctity. Okay, this is the opinion of some.
I think that depends pretty much on the custom in the community, in the family.
Yeah, but even Rav Moshe, Olam HaSholem, I mean, Paskin, you know, that, if it's written in English characters, then it doesn't have the same sanctity. Still, it doesn't mean that you take it and throw it in the garbage. You don't do that, okay? That's wrong.
So
yes?
The word God occurs in all papers lately, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to put different meanings to this word.
Okay, yeah. Of course. So in that case, as I say, you can rely upon my mission.
Yeah, like, he wants to
spend
out there and has no
yes.
holy minute.
This is an aside, but you know when you write a letter, you write the day, the samach, and then the...
Okay, that means the siyata d'shmaya, means with God's help. The siyata d'shmaya. You say it in Purkan, you can Purkan, right. The siyata d'shmaya, v'yizkufa, in other words, help from heaven, and good health, and so on, health of body, etc., etc., right, right. Yeah. A lot of people, instead of writing Beis Hei, Baruch Hashem, they write Mesiyata
Deshmaya.
But I thought
that has more power. Some of my Beis
Hei, yes, it's
true. Not more power, it's a question, you know, as the, you know, whatever. One will do it one way, one will do it the other way, okay.
Some
write
Beis Hei, yes, it's true.
Correct. Or if you want, Beis Hashem is Borek. Okay, yes. No, I've never seen a Greek Torah. I've read Greek texts, you know, Septuagint. I'll talk about that in a few minutes if we get there, okay?
did they actually go about doing this? They were still discussing whether it may or may not or would have the sanctity in the Talmud. Now we're discussing it.
This is what the question is, whether a Sefer Torah written in any language other than Hebrew would be okay. All right, so according to the Tanakhama, in other words, according to the first opinion, it would seem to be okay. But Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel restricts it only to what?
Greek.
Only to Greek. Okay? So that this is where the matter stands right now. Okay. So let's continue now with the text. Okay. Naturally, immediately, you know, you have a statement where it says, that the Sifrei Torah can be written in any language. Raminu. Hey, we have a contrary teaching. What is the contrary teaching? It says, Mikra. Sheksova Targum. Let's say, something which should be written in the Bible in Hebrew. And instead they wrote it in what? An Aramaic translation. Okay? Or the Targum. You have a word which is, you know, it's an Aramaic word. Sheksova Mikra. But they wrote it what? They wrote it in Hebrew letters, so that it looks like part of the, you know, as part of the Chumash, part of the Torah, excuse me. Or Ksav Ivri. Ksav Ivri means over here not our way of writing, but Ksav Ivri over here means the old Hebrew script that they used once upon a time. Okay. So if a Torah were written that way, is it sacred or not? The answer is that all of these cases, Einu Metamis HaYadayim, right? They do not defile the hands. In other words, they do not possess the sanctity of a real Sefer Torah, right? Archi Yechtevenu B'Ksav Ashuris Al HaSefer V'Yom. The only Torah that has sanctity is that it has to be written in the Ksav Ashuris, in other words, this kind of printing, right? And it has to be written on a, here a Sefer doesn't mean a book, but it means in a scroll, right? or vidyo. Not only that, it has to be written also with a special ink that a sofer has to use in order to make sure that the writing remains as permanent as possible. Okay? So, in other words, we see already from the quotation of Baraisa that they quote over here that not everybody accepts the idea of writing it in any language. It doesn't have the same sanctity. Okay? Omar Rava, so Rava says, Loi Kasha. He says, nah, that's not a Kasha. All right? We continue now on Daf Tes Omen Aleph, which is the next one over here. Take and pass. Okay?
You got any more down there?
Yeah.
This is the new one.
We also have candies for anybody who needs it. Okay. So Robert raised a, he says, "Lo kasha." Now he says, "It's not really a kasha. I can come up with an answer." What is the answer? It says, "Kan de gufen shabadu, kan de gufen shalahem." In other words, if you write a Sefer Torah, he says, no matter what language, right? If you do it in the way we're supposed to, using our characters, then it would be kosher. If you do it the gufen shalahem, in other words, the alphabet that they have, then in that case it wouldn't be kosher. That is, it wouldn't be valid, right? I don't have to tell you that's exactly the same thing that you asked before. You know, what if you wrote, for example, let's say, you wrote a Sefer Torah, let's say, in German and used Hebrew characters or something like that. It would not be. It has to be written, as we said, how only? Ksav Ashuri, right? Or Ashuris, as it says over here. It has to be written on a scroll, and it has to be written permanently. These are some of the character misses. All right.
One question.
Yeah.
How far back, or how early did these characters that we know of today, which are the ones that are considered the kosher ones and the proper ones,
okay,
sacred ones, when did they establish themselves as the sacred script?
You're asking a very important question. Obviously, our sages have assumed that this was the original way of writing Hebrew. Okay? How do we know that?
If you remember...
Okay, yeah. Let me show you. I'll demonstrate to you why they assumed that. We learned several months ago, earlier in the text over here, Pesachus Megillah, that it speaks over there that, first of all, who were the ones who originated the Manzapach? Okay? Manzapach. Manzapach means, you know, mem and final mem. Nun and final mem. In other words, two forms for these letters. Okay? Secondly, so they came to the conclusion that one opinion says that Sofrim, in other words, the sages who came back from Babylonian exile are the ones who did it, okay? But there's another opinion that says, no, it's much more ancient than that. It goes back, the proof goes back to a tradition about the Ten Commandments. What did it say over there? It said that Mem and Samach, they stayed in their place by a miracle, because you know there's nothing. I mean, yeah, there's nothing to hold on. Exactly. I mean, of course, we're talking about the Shlosser Mem. You know, I mean, the final Mem, where okay.
Doesn't stand on anything. Doesn't hang on anything.
Yeah, and what are you going to do? You know, with the middle part. So it's only a miracle that it was there in the text of the Ten Commandments, and the Sabbath is the same thing, okay? With the others, you can usually tack on to something or other, but Mem and Sabbath says they were there by a miracle. That's how they were hung in the Ten Commandments, okay? So in other words, that according to this tradition, the letters go back already to that particular time. On the other hand, most of the writing that we have from that earlier period until roughly, I would say, about, let's say, till the return of the Babylonian exile, okay? The early inscriptions that we have are written in the other one that they call Ksav Ivri over here, okay? Why Ksav Ivri? One opinion is because it was the script that was used, when the Avraham Avinu came from across the river in order to come to Eretz Israel. Yes. Well, we're talking about a miracle, and the miracle is very, very difficult for to picture. I'll be honest with you, right? It's difficult. Okay?
Definitely.
Yes.
But the second set of Lukot that Moshe Rabbeinu brought, it was still available, it was still in the Aron Kodesh.
Yeah, but it got lost as time went on, I don't have to tell you. It got lost. I had to bury it, right?
But before the destruction of the first temple, and the in the temple, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes. Right.
So
okay.
Had description of writing the Moshe Rabbeinu.
Okay. Definitely, I mean, if you take a look at things that are written, after the return from Babylon exile, then we begin to see letters that are formed in the form that's familiar to us. That's
the
why
Dead
I
sea
said,
scrolls.
If you go into the, the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Written in...
Most of them are written in the kind of script that we have
that
over here. Right.
If you look at the encyclopedia, you will see on one page, probably 15, 20, Red Fish and the Baby Lion, with differences.
Okay, the question is, when did these things become crystallized, understand? So, of course, that goes back already to the time of the Talmud, no question about it, because, for example, with Rabbi Meir, we learned the Gemara, which said, that you said to him, what are you? And he said, he's a sofer, if you remember, okay? And he was told, your work is very, very precious, very important, because if you chas v'shalom, you should leave out a letter, or if you should add a letter to the text, then it makes the whole Sefer Torah possible, okay? So we see that they already had the rules. We have a collection also of halachas that go way back again to the Talmudic times, and it's called Maseches Sofer, where they speak about these things too. So the traditions are old, several thousand years, you see. But nevertheless, there was another alphabet also used by Jews at an earlier period, and if you'll take a look at coins that were coined, let's say, by Bar Kokhba, you see that he went back again to the script on the coins that he did. You see, for example, it says Shana Bet, right? L'Cheirut Yisrael, right? Second year of the freedom of the Jewish people, right?
I've seen one to say for Torah, in which there were nine lines erased and 10 lines put in. Obviously, the sofer forgot to write one line.
Yes, it's an ancient script. Yes.
That's the word they give it.
The ancient Hebraic script. Okay. Canaanites also used it. The Moabites use it. We have they call it a steel. In other words, it's like a tablet, that they found. Beisha Melech Moab, celebrating his victory over the people of Israel. And it's written in that ancient script. In Yerushalayim, you have the inscription that they found over the tunnel that brought water from the Shiloah, right, to the city itself and so on. And there they describe, the miracle that took place, that they dug from one end, they dug from the other end, and lo and behold, they managed to use it to meet. And so that's what you consider, you know. It's a tremendous engineering feat, and it goes back thousands and thousands of years. Yes.
Nothing new under the sun.
All right, sounds fine. Okay, as I pointed out before you came, I mean that you know our the older alphabet formed the basis for the Greek alphabet, the Latin alphabet, and so on. Okay, all right. So, at any rate, this is what Robert says. Needless to say, if Robert says that, so Abaye always has an objection. So I'm only Abaye. That was Abaye said to him, but Mayu Kimta. What kind of an answer are you giving me over here that you apply it, you know, that you use, you know. Right. So, at any rate, we're on Daf Tes Omer Aleph. We're on the line 3. Okay? Whoever wants to know, my Iriya Mikra Shekosu Targum, Betargum Shekosu Mikra. It says, give me a case where we have a scriptural verse in which we find Targum written, or Targum in which we have the language of the Bible written. So it says, Afilu mikro shekosu mikro, v'targum shekosu targum. It says, all right, look, even if it is a Bible in which it's written correctly in the biblical form, or Targum which is written in Targum, name. The same thing would apply, says the Hokatoni Achi Yichtivenu Asherisa Sefer Bidyo. In other words, if you were to use the old alphabet, no good. It has to be written how? Whether it's Targum or whether it is the Torah text itself, it has to be written in the kind of letters that we use, right? Asheris. Also, it has to be written Al HaSefer, in other words, it has to be written in a Megillah form, you know, sheets of the parchment. And Bidyon has to be written with the proper ink. Ela lo kasha. So it's not a kasha. Ho rabbon ho rabbi shimon gamliel. So the kasha is about why did rabbi shimon gamliel say that you could write a Sefer Torah in Greek, right? So it says, rabbi shimon gamliel, if, okay. So let's take his theory first of all. Ho yikar yivonis. Okay, so fine. So we have a Bible that may be written in Greek. Ela lo kasha. But he says it's not a kasha because kambis forin, kambis filin the mezuzas. Maybe there's a difference between the Sifrei Torah and between filin the mezuzas. According to the Mishnah, there is. Why? Filin the mezuzas, we said that they have to be written only in Hebrew and so on, you know, on the cloth and the ink and so on. My tama, why? Mishum dichsiv behu, because we find in reference to Tfilin Mezuzas, it says v'hoyu, you know, v'hoyu hadvorim v'eila, shenachim tzav v'hoyu maludah, and so on. Okay. So, since it says that, then it means behavi yason yuhu. They have to be written exactly the way I instruct you to be, so that they ought to be written. So now they want to know, my targum shekosu mikra. Ikra, right? So, where do we find any Targum which is written in the Bible? Of course, when I say the Bible, I mean in the Torah. So it says, Bishlam or Torah, okay, in the Torah, yes. Ikra, we have what? Yigar Sahadusa, which I explained to you last week, means literally the heap of stones serving as a witness, and this we find in the agreement which was made between Lavan and Yaakov, that neither would pass this boundary line, so to speak, in order to harm the other one. Elohacha. But here we're talking about what? My Targum Ikum. Where do we have Targum? So he says, Eloh Kasha. He says, no, all right, that's not a question. He says, Kam de Megillah, Kam de Sforim. Says, in the Megillah, maybe we have. And in Sefer Torah, maybe we don't. Why? Megillah, or maybe the other way around. Maybe Megillah should not be written in with any Targum language, But Sefer Torah may be all right. We said that Yusuf proves that there are two Aramaic words in the Torah, right? But Megillah should not have any Aramaic, right? My Talmud, for what reason? It says, because it is written in it, Kirsavom v'chil shonam, that the Megillah has to be written exactly according to the way they write it and according to the way the language is. So, all right. So maybe the Megillah. So it says, my targum shekosu mikra ikra. So tell me, where do we find Aramaic, which is written in a book of the Bible? It says, Omer Rapapa said, okay, I'll show you. It says, it's written, V'nishma piskam hamelech. And the decree of the king will be heard, you know, through all the Medinas and so on. So the words piskam, he says, this is an Aramaic word, and yet it's there, where? In the book of the Bible. Rav Nachum by Yitzchak, and not just the book of the Bible, it's written in the Megillah, right? Gilas Esther. Rav Nachum by Yitzchak Omar, he said, it's written, V'chol anoshim yitnu yekol avalehin, that all the women are to give honor unto their husbands. And it says, if it were pure Hebrew, it would have said, yitnu kavod. So, the very fact that it says yikor, this is already an Aramaism, okay? Meaning honor, okay?
Kadisha
Yakir. No. Okay. Of course, I mean, we say it in Baruch Shmei, absolutely, right. We also say it, of course, in the, you know, the, like, Kariba in the, yeah, okay, yeah. Rav Ashi Omar says, I'll show you another one in the Megillah. It says, Ketanya Ahi Bishor Seforim, as it is written in other books, Rav Yehuda Ahi Letanya Tefillin Mezuzain Nechtov Nela Shuris, Rav Yehuda Tiri Yevonis. It says, I'll come back again to this, where we already learned that what? That Tefillin Mezuzis cannot be written in any language except using the Asheris letters, in other words, the kind that we're used to using. But our sages permitted Yevonis, they permitted the writing of a Torah in Greek. So the question now is upon this, Hoksiv, isn't it written Hoyu, which means what? That the Torah should not be written in Greek, but should be written what? In Hebrew only. So it says, Elo, Amos, so he says, all right, let me say it as follows. Sforim nichtovim b'chol moshem. Okay. Mishnah had stated before that what? That Sifrei Torah can be written in any language, but v'habu seinu itiri yevonis. And our sages permitted it to be written in Greek. So they say itiru, they permitted it. Miklal, that would prove what? That the Tanakhama osar, that the first opinion says it's prohibited to write in any language. Elo emo. So again, we have to fix up the language to say as follows: Rabbi Seinu lo hitirushi koshuel yevonis. That our sages came to the conclusion that a sefer Torah can only be written in Greek. You know, I'm talking, I mean, besides Hebrew, obviously, but no other language. V'tanya. And we've also had a baraisa which says Amar Rav Yehuda, that Rabbi Shimon says the Afkishay to Rabbi Seinu yevonis. Even when our sages, our rabbis, permitted the writing of a Sefer Torah in Greek, lo itirela b'Sefer Torah, they permitted it only as far as the five books of Moses are concerned, but not in any other one. Umishum Masa, and the reason was because of the story about the Talmai HaMelech, King Ptolemy, right? And we said, the Tanya, we learned, Masa b'Talmai HaMelech, the story about Talmai HaMelech, Shekina Yeshivim Mishnayim Zakenim, he gathered together 72 elders, of course, from where? From Yerushalayim. Ichnison Mishivim Mishnayim Botim. They put them into 72 different chambers. Velogi lo lahem amakin son. And at the same time, he did not reveal unto them for what reason he had gathered them together. So the Nichtan says, so kolechod diechod. And he came into each person's room individually. The Yomalahim, and he said to them, Kisfuli Teres Moshe Rabchem, write for me the Torah of your teacher Moshe. So Nochan Hakadosh Baruch Hu Belev Kol Echad VeYechad Eitza. So the Rebbeinu Shel Olam literally gave, put into the hearts of each and every one of them a wise counsel. The Iskimu Kulam Ladas Achas, and they all came up exactly with the very same answer. In other words, with the very same translation, right? Now, not only that, but even more so, what is remarkable is that they all came up with what? With the same changes that they made in the Greek translation. And here we have a listing again, if you remember, of the changes made in the Greek text. The Kosvulo, they wrote for him, that is for the king, Elohim Bara Bereishis. They said, God created in the beginning. Instead of saying, in the beginning, God created. I explained to you last week, which we didn't record over here, that subsequently I took a look at the current official Greek text, and there it begins by saying, in the beginning, God created. Okay. So the answer is, of course, that the Greek text has also undergone revision as time went on. Yes? I'm talking about what we call the Septuagint.
We have multiple translations into English.
Yes.
Right. So
correct.
There were multiple translations into Greek.
There were. You're absolutely right, there were. But one text became sort of considered the accepted text of the Greek translation, right? And that became the Septuagint, okay? Septuagint is Latin for Septuaginta, which means 70. Okay?
70.
Yeah. Which, because, you know, it says over here 72, but, you know, the translator of the 70. Okay? So that is considered the text. But needless to say, before there was an official Septuagint text, it could have been exactly the way the Gemara describes it over here, because this is a very ancient tradition.
Are there in existence today any Sifrei Torah that are written in Greek?
No. No, we don't have any. If there ever were, and I won't say that there weren't, okay? Remember, the Arabs destroyed the great library which existed in Alexandria, which contained thousands and thousands of manuscripts written in Greek, including presumably also a translation of the Torah. Okay, so they destroyed it. All right, another change that they made is Eser Odom Etzelem Uvitmus. The Rebbeinu Shalom says, "I will make man in my image," instead of saying, "Let's make man in our image." Okay. Of course, obviously, the reason being, as we said, you know, because we don't want to assume that there is more than one God, and if they translated "let us," it might give people the wrong impression to think that there's more than one God. Okay. Vayechal b'yom ha'shishi, vayishbos b'yom ha'shvi. Problem with the text over there is written that the Rebbeinu Shalom vayechal b'yom ha'shvi, right? That the Rebbeinu Shalom finished his acts of creation on the seventh day, and he rested on the seventh day. So they translated, they changed the translation to say that he finished his work when? On the sixth day, and then he rested on the seventh day. To us, we don't make those changes, because to us, the Shabbos itself is also the completion of the act of creation. That Rebbeinu Shalom not only wanted to create, you know, a world, but he also wanted to create Shabbos as well for the world. Okay. Then, of course, the Torah says, "Zachor nekevo bara osab," that the Rebbeinu Shalom created mankind as male and female, right? He created them, but they translated not that way, but they translated "Zachor nekevo bara o." That God created him male and female. Why? Because if there was one man who was the progenitor of all mankind, and therefore he was not only the progenitor of all mankind, but he was also both male and female. There is a tradition that says that Ben Shalom created man as two parts of, in other words, he had two faces.
Androgynous.
Right.
Androgynous.
And dryness, right, okay, yeah, okay. Well, correct, which would mean it has both the characteristics of male and female. Okay. The low costs were brought. Okay, then it's written, Hava Erdo V'Lasham Sepasam. Again, this is what we read last Shabbos in the story of the Tower of Babel, where the Vedic says, Hava Nerdo V'Novlasham. Let us go down and mix up their languages, right? But here they changed it to, I am about to go down and I will change their languages. All right. Then it's written, Batitzak Sora Bekirba Lemor, right? Sarah laughed to herself, saying, you know, after here I am, I become old and withered, and am I suddenly going to recapture youth again, right? So they felt that this is posthumous. So, what did they change? They changed to Batitzak Sora Bekirba. Sarah laughed among those who were close to her. She said, how could it be? Okay, in order to spare, right? Of course, what did she say after that? She said, and my husband is also, Adonis, okay, my husband is an old man, so how could I ever think even of, you know, having a child? Right. Then, when we're talking about Shimon and Levi in the bracha of Yaakov, he didn't give them a bracha, he didn't like them, okay, that particular point. He was angry with them because he said, Kibi Yapam Hogu Shor, and that is this how they translated. This is the original text, right? Because in their anger they slayed a human being. And in their desire they hamstringed an ox, okay? And of course, according to one tradition, Shor represents Joseph. In other words, what did they try to do? They tried to, you know, to kill him, or at least, you know, to make him impotent, whatever it may be, okay? So they translated different. They didn't want to say that they killed a man. So what did they do? They changed it from Hogavish to Hogushar, okay? And therefore, if that's the case, what they do with the word Shar at the end of that pasuk, it says, if it's some Ikru Ovus, and in their anger, literally a hamstring, or whatever, how you want to translate it, a fatted calf. Okay?
Yeah. Also, wasn't the Ptolemy's wife named Shul?
Yeah, all right, we're coming to that. Right. Vaykach Moshe's Ishtay V'Yesponov, right? So it's written that Moshe took his wife and his children, Vayakivim al Nosei B'nei Adam, and he put them on a carrier for human beings. Corresponding to originally put him on a donkey. It's possible to say that Moshe Rabbeinu could only afford a donkey. He should have had a Cadillac or something, so that therefore they changed it to a carrier of human beings. A wagon or something, all right. Then, how long did the people of Israel stay in Egypt? Well, you have different readings for that. 210 is our tradition. It doesn't say that. This is by tradition that where it says, Redu Shama, go down over there. So we say, you see, the word Redu is a sign that Resh means 200, Dalet is 4, Vav is 6, so in other words, 210. So that in reality, the Jews were enslaved in Egypt only 210 years, which would also correspond, you know, with how many generations there were between Yaakov, his children, until finally we find, you know, Amnon and Yocheved, you know, the Amram and Yocheved, I mean, the father and the mother of Moshe Rabbeinu, and then Moshe and Miriam and Aaron, okay? So the number of generations that we have going down that way, okay. So that's closer to it, right.
Instead of the 400,
right? Right, but on the other hand, what the Rabbeinu Shalom tell Avraham Avinu, he said to him that your descendants will be slaves for 400 years, Abba Meyoshon, right? So that, therefore, how do you reconcile the two figures? So what then is, because we have our own reconciliation, but how they reconcile is to say, Moshe Rabbeinu Yisrael, and the time that the people of Israel dwelt, Asher Yoshu Mitzrayim, in the land of Egypt, Uvishor Arotzos, and in other lands as well. So, and they changed it to what? To Arba Meyoshon. They changed it to 400 Yes, okay. So that was the change that they made. It's contrary to the text. Okay. Right. So, therefore, I mean, what is our explanation? Our explanation is that between the time of Abraham Avinu and the time that the redemption from Egypt came, so it was 400 years. Okay? So that's how we reconcile it. Then it's written, Vayishlach ha-Zatute b'nei Yisrael, V'yal-Zatute b'nei Yisrael v'shalach yotam. This we find towards the end of Pasha, Mishpatim, the other Pasha Mishpatim, where it's written, first of all, Vayishlach ha-Nareh b'nei Yisrael, which we translate as he sent the young people of the children of Israel, and then by Eloi Lois, and then it's the Atzilei B'nai Yisrael, and then it's written, and as far as the nobles of the children of Israel, Lo Shalach Yodo, Ben Yisroel did not do any harm to them. Now, in both cases, how was it translated by the Septuagint? They wanted to make it, not to have two different words, Na'arei and Atzilei, one implying young people who are not necessarily noble, and Atzilei, which would imply nobility. So therefore, they translated by the word Zatute, which might be translated A, as youngsters, but it could also be translated as nobles. And therefore, this translation would give the impression that who did he send? He sent the nobility, and at the same time, the Rebbe Shlom did not punish the nobility because by Yochlu, by Yushtu, that they ate and they drank in the presence of giving the covenant to the Ten Commandments. All right. We continue now on the next page. Okay, take a pass, please.
So we have five children for some of the candies here. Thank you very much. That's fine.
Yes.
Now you made it difficult.
Ask my kid, don't
you? No. I have a multiplicity of choices.
Well, okay. They come for the honey because of the hate.
Right.
Yeah, you have the. Why didn't you take it? This is it. No, this is the old one.
Perhaps it's under here.
No,
let's see.
No.
Here's Yud. Here's Yud Ahmed Aleph.
No, but we're not on Yud yet. We're still on Tet.
Tet.
So no, I gave it to be passed.
Oh, okay.
Who stopped the chain over here?
No, I don't know.
I took one. Here it is.
Right, you're on Tet Ahmed Aleph.
All right. Okay, double take one.
Right,
Here we go. Then another translation.
Okay.
Moshe Rabbeinu says to the people of Israel, this is in the incident of Korach. Korach makes all kinds of charges against Moshe Rabbeinu, right? So Moshe Rabbeinu says, Lo chamor echod mehem nososi.
Right?
Says, I did not take any donkey from them.
Right.
Nor did I harm any one of them. So how did they translate the word chamor? As we can see, they had a prejudice against chamor, against the donkey, the poor donkey. So what did they say instead? Lo chemed echod mehem nasasi. I have not taken from them anything which was precious. Okay? In other words, any gift or whatever it may be, or appropriated something that did not belong to me, I have not done.
It seems to run through, because there were a lot of leaders who say that I didn't take a shoelace.
Right. And so was Abraham Avinu, right.
Yeah, right.
Oh, Shmuel also said this.
Shmuel said similarly, right. Correct. Okay. All right. Then it's written in Sefer Devarim, Parshas Eschadon, we find over there that it's written that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, he says, don't bow down to the sun, the moon, the stars, right? Asher chalak ad Hashem lekecho Yisrael, right? Lechol ha'abin. Which means, which the Rabbeinu Shalom gave as a portion to all nations. So now the question is, what might be the implication if a person didn't know the Jewish tradition? The answer is that the Rabbeinu Shalom, in other words, is giving carte blanche to all peoples to do what? To observe, you know, to worship the sun, the moon, the stars, and so on, what we call Avodah Zarah. Okay? So therefore, they wanted to make sure that this is not the idea. So instead, what did they do? So they changed it. They added one word. Shechalak HaRashem Lekecho Yisam Lohoir Lechol Amim. Rabbeinu Shalom gave all these things, in other words, he put them in the sky to do what? To them, in order to give light to all the nations. Okay, right. And of course, there's Gemara, Avodah Zarah, and so on, you know, the daughter of the emperor once asked, you know, why did the Rabbeinu Shalom bother to create them, knowing that, you know, they are going to be worshipped by people? So the answer they gave is no. And if you have foolish people who worship these things, should the world be deprived of them? They're there. The Rabbeinu Shalom wants it for all mankind. All right. Then it's written, Vayelech vayavod elihim achirim asher lo tzivisi lo avdam. All right. And then it's written afterwards, you know, that the man went and he worshipped
different gods.
Yeah, different gods, which I have not commanded that they should be worshipped. All right. So that's another change that they made in the text. Not a Gevaldic change over there, but nevertheless is what it was. Okay. And then finally we come to one that was mentioned before, that I mentioned, where it's written, close below, they wrote their translation for him, Es Tziras HaRaglayim, below, close below, Es Vanevis. Okay?
Right.
Among the different creatures, among the different animals that we are not allowed to eat because they're not kosher, one of them is the Arnevis, usually translated as the hare, H-A-R-E. Okay? So, they translated it not as the hare, right, the Arnevis, but rather they translated it as Tziras HaRaglayim, the young-footed animal, okay?
Yeah.
So the question is, why didn't they translate it, you know, with the word Arnevis? So they say, Midnesha Ishtar Shel Talmai Arnevis Shimon. Gemara says, because Talmai's, you know, Talmai's wife was called Arnevis, in other words, the Greek word for hair, okay?
Would be like,
right,
like some of the some of the Anglo-Saxon women here, I call themselves bunny.
Right. You're right. Okay. Shelo yomar, so that the king should not say, Sochaku bi Yehudim, Jews are making fun of me. Itil Hashem ishti batora, and they have added the name of my wife into the Torah in order to say that she's what? That she's a treifa creature, a treifa animal. Okay? The explanation, as I told you last time, however, I heard was a little bit different. By the way, this is Rashi's. I mean, that he says, you know, that actually Rashi says something else. He says that she had short feet. That's why they called her. You know, our nevers. Okay, so they changed it in order to compliment her, and she shouldn't be insulted. Okay. But.
She's a stump.
Yeah, whatever. Right. However, I heard from my teacher, Professor Shaul Lieberman, great Torah scholar, that in reality it was in reference to Ptolemy Lagos. You know, you had so many Ptolemies that they had different names. One says that the Ptolemy over here is Philadelphus, literally the lover of the brothers, okay, in other words. Okay, that's why we have the name Philadelphia, you know, okay. City of brotherly love, I'm sure you've heard it right, okay. Yeah, the first part, the Philos, is you know, a lover.
That was not a compliment,
right.
Colin.
And then whatever you have after that, so.
Okay.
Oh. Adele Faust. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, like philosophy, right? Sophia means wisdom. So that therefore means a lover of wisdom, okay? Tell you what Philip means. Of course, it was named after the father of Alexander, Philip. Phil, I mean, we said, means what? Lover. What does Hippos mean?
Horse.
A horse, right. In other words,
very
he was
good.
A horse lover.
Very good. Very good.
So
yeah,
that's how
sure.
The name,
Philip.
Right, Philippos might be. Okay. All right.
Very
at
good.
Any rate.
Sure, you're a lover of horses?
Yeah, I'm a lover of horses.
Everyone to the track.
Everyone to the
I may love a horse. I don't love what the horse excretes. Okay.
Right.
At any rate, so he said, you know, that the one whom they wanted to make sure was not offended was Ptolemy Lagos. Lagos means a hare.
Oh.
Means a hare, a rabbit. Okay. I don't know why they called him rabbit, but they called him. I mean, I guess if I could write a word, we called it a novel called, you know, Rabbit. So it's the same stuff.
Rabbit.
All right. Yeah. All right. Now, they want to get back again. This is already where we finished last week. As I say, since I didn't have it on the tape, so I thought it's a good idea to finish up.
This week I understand it.
Good. Okay. Not messy. You know, sometimes the second time around you get it better.
Right. Right. Right.
Now, if you remember, the end of the Mishnah says that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, he says, Af Bisforim Loyatil Sheyichkosu Elohim. He said that even in Sifrei Torah, the only language other than Hebrew that would be permitted would be what? In Greek. Okay.
Right.
So, before we were saying, you know, about the miracle that they all translated, all these things and so on. All right. But he had a different reason for this, as we'll see in a few moments. Omer Rabba Bohu Omer Rabbi Yochanan Bohu, and it said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, the halachic Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. He says, the halachic takafalas Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. In other words, what? Sefer Torah can only be written in Hebrew, with the exception of Greek. The Omer Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Yochanan said, he says, my time is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. What is the reason why Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says only in Greek? So he says, Omakro, because we have a pasuk. In fact, we read it in the Torah this past week. It says, Yaftel Akim Li Yefes, the Yishkom Yohalei Shem. May God give the beauty of Yefes, you know, in other words, Japhet, right?
Yeah.
So that he may dwell in the tents of Shem.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he says, the Borav shall Yefes, Yiyu Bohalei Shem. Let the words of Yefes, in other words, let the Greek language also be in what? In the tents of Shem, in other words, given a Jewish interpretation. Okay?
There were a lot of Jews living in Alexandria who spoke
Philo,
you know, so they
had
to write.
There's no question about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know how many Jews were in Salonika before the war?
I don't know about a quarter of a million, certainly at least 50,000 or something like that. But, you know. Yes? That's Yafet.
Yeah.
Right, right. Of course, if you take a look in Mauritius, you'll find that Yavon and others, you know, are descendants of him, okay?
Hmm.
Well, of course, Yavon became, you know, the prototype Greek, okay? Of course, they're trying to find in Greek, you know, what it corresponds to. So in Greek, you have Ionia, but, you know, it's not Ionia, you know, it's Yoni, okay? So that the Yoni and the Yavan, you see, they correspond to each other. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, Ionic column and so on. Yeah, of course, absolutely. Right. All right. The Amor. So now the question is, Gomer Mogog, why can't they write in the language of Gomer or Logo? They're also descendants of the, you know, Yafet and so on, right? So he says, Omer Rav Chiya Bar Abba. So Rav Chiya Bar Abba said, Hainu Tamo, the reason, Take, why Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that it can only be in the actual Greek language itself and not in any other one, is the Siv, because we have this pasuk which says, Yaftel Akim Yafes, right? So, which means what? Yaf Yafuso, the beauty. You see, Yaftin Yaf Yafus, right? Mm-hmm. The beauty of Yafes, Yafus Shal Yafes, Yehei Be'ohel Hashem. Let it be there in the tents of Shem. Okay. Now, okay. With this we learn then that a Sefer Torah may be written in Greek, but that only, and it, even if it's written in Greek, how does it have to be written? It still has to be written on pieces of parchment, and it has to be written in ink. In other words, the same as the way a Sefer Torah is written, but no other language. And of course, a Sefer Torah, to be a kosher one in the Hebrew, has to be written not in the ancient script, not in the Ksav Ivri, as we said, which would be the ancient script that we find in old inscriptions and so on, but it has to be written Ashuris. It can only be written in what we call the Assyrian characters, Ashuris. Okay.
Now,
this is the term that we use for them. Right.
Ashuris.
Yeah.
Now, the point that's being made here is it may be written in Greek and it will have the same holiness.
Yes, it will have the sanctity of the
same sanctity,
right,
as the one,
right,
written in Hebrew.
Right.
That's the difference between the way it is today. It was the language of the populace, so they were accommodating themselves to the populace. Is that
that's true, but you know, the populace spoke other languages. They also spoke Aramaic. If anything, there were more Jews in Eretz Israel and Babylonian, so who did not speak Greek, they spoke Aramaic.
Right.
But nevertheless, it says that if it is Mikra, it has to be Mikra. In other words, it has to be a biblical text written in Hebrew, and it cannot be what? It cannot be Targum, except for the two words, Yigar Sa'adusa, that's all. So the Sefer Torah cannot be written in Aramaic, period. That's what they're saying. Yes, that's what they mean over here.
Yeah.
Right. We use it in the broader sense, but but here the text itself, this is what they're referring to when they talk about Targum. Okay, so as we used to say in Babylon, we would say Targum Loshen. Have you ever heard the expression?
Doctor, just as a historical note, up to what point in time were Sifrei Torah written in Greek, and how prevalent?
Well, I don't know really how to answer how prevalent they were. There's no question that in the Alexandrian Jewish community, which numbered maybe about 1 million at the time of Caesar, Augustus, and so on and so forth, at that particular time, that they probably must have had quite a few copies of the Torah written in Greek, right?
And
but they're all lost.
And now, at this point, has a decision been made now, or is it still going to be in discussion of people who disagree? Are we finished with that?
We're finished with this.
We're finished, and they've decided this is the way they're going.
Yes. Okay. This is prevailing view. Fadik, right. That's Allah. All right. So now we can go on to the next thing. Okay. We're still with Ein Bein, but we're coming to the end of the Ein Bein business. Okay? All right. The next Ein Bein, what is the difference between one thing and another, deals now with the question of the Kohen Godol. Okay? It says, Ein Bein Kohen Moshuach B'Shemen HaMishcho Merubah B'Godol. Okay. There is no difference between the Kohen Godol, who has been anointed with oil, as compared to the Kohen Godol, who is the Kohen Godol by virtue of the fact that he wears more garments. All right. Now let me explain what we're talking about over here. Okay? Number one. From the time of Aaron to the time of the destruction of the first place on Mikdash, okay, whoever was chosen to be a Kohen Godol had to be anointed with oil. Okay? Just as a king had to be anointed with oil, So a Kohen Gadol also had to be anointed with oil. This we find already, you know, reference to Aaron, and then, you know, his successors would be, you know, anointed with oil when they assumed the position of Kohen Gadol. Okay. All right. So, what about the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, where you had a Kohen Gadol officiating in the Beis HaMikdash, right? Okay. But he had not been anointed with oil. So that, therefore, what distinguishes him from the other Kohanim? So the answer is, we go back again to the Torah, and we see that the Torah says that, you know, the ordinary Kohen has to wear certain garments, okay? But the Kohen Gadol has, in addition to those garments, has to wear such things as, for example, the koshen, in other words, the breastplate, has to wear also the tzitz, the special, it's like a metal tablet upon which God's name was written over there. It says Kodesh Tad Hashem, you know, upon his forehead and so on. So there were eight such things that the Kohen Gadol had to wear. In other words, four of the Kohen Hedyotas, we would say, the common Kohen, and the four additional that he had to wear, you know, being the Kohen Gadol. Now, of course, in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, the Kohen Gadol also wore the eight garments. But as I said, now in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, where there is no oil to anoint him, so this is the officiating uniform that he had to wear. It's the same one, but okay. So, they say, yes. Pardon me? Why they couldn't? Okay, the original Shemen HaMishkan, which they used for anointing, was buried. And that was it. That was the end. Okay? Just as the Ohren Kodesh was also buried.
They couldn't make it.
Right.
Otherwise,
right.
God or something.
It's written right. Right. You could not reproduce
it.
You couldn't reproduce it. Okay?
Why the... There's a breast, but I'm thinking of
woman
and
tumen.
What about
the
words?
Yeah, correct.
That's
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, right. And they were placed in the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. Right.
They were included in the.
In the breastplate, right, yes. So, you know, if you go back to, you know, like Parsha Tetzaveh, where you have a description of the garments of the Kohen Gadol, so over there you'll find it. Okay. All right. So he says there's no difference, shall we say, in laws pertaining to the Kohen who was anointed with oil, in other words, the Kohen Gadol in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, as compared to the rules that the Kohen Gadol has to observe if he's a Kohen Gadol in the second Beis HaMikdash, and where, you know, the distinguishing characteristic is the fact that he's wearing the many different garments prescribed for the Kohen Gadol. Okay. Elo par habal kol ha-mitzvos, right? Except for a certain type of a sacrifice. It's written about the chatos. Chatos is a sin offering. Okay. And then Torah says that there are times when a sin offering has to be brought on behalf of the Kahal, the entire community of Israel, that they did the wrong thing. Or it's written in HaKohen HaMoshiach Yechto LiAshpas HaHal. If the king, I mean if the Kohen who is anointed with oil should sin, causing the entire people to fall into sin, in other words, he gave the wrong decision, people follow his decision and it was wrong, so in that case he had to bring what? He had to bring a par. He had to bring a bull to serve as a chatos, as a sin offering. Okay?
The Kohen?
The Kohen, yeah.
The Kohen
or no, right, because
so
he was the one who did it.
Where would he get it from? I mean, he was depending upon the congregation to give him.
Okay, you ask a good question, but the answer is that the Kohen Gadol also could own property. And right. Now, specifically for Yom Kippur, he actually had to have his par coming out of his own pocket. He had to pay for it. You know, it had to be his, not something that the congregation, that the community of Israel provides for him. Okay? With other animals that were part of the daily sacrifice or the additional sacrifices for Shabbos and Yom Tov and so on, that came out of community funds that were used specifically for this purpose.
So
okay,
about, right?
But this he had to pay for out of his own pocket.
Okay, now so what about the Levites? They did not have property.
Correct. Theoretically, they did.
Theoretically,
yeah,
they did.
Theoretically, they did.
One, right. Right.
Well,
so
they had.
So if they had to do a.
Well, they got by some things like that.
Well,
they also had
fields.
Cities that belonged to them.
Limited.
Right?
Limited.
48
limited.
Cities that
yeah.
were.
Yeah,
cities
fields.
Assigned to the Levium. Okay.
So like if they had to bring a sacrifice, would that be from their own or from something that was...
Yeah, well, in that case, it would be their own. If you're giving a personal sacrifice, then you have to bring it for your own. So obviously...
We have to assume that they had
they had some sort of an income. Okay. All right. So getting back to our mission again. All right. So... One difference that they stress over here is the fact that in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, if the Kohen Gadol who is Mashiach, in other words, I don't mean that he's the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but I mean that he was anointed with oil, then if he gave the wrong decision and people sinned as a result of it, then he had to bring this Barachatas. Okay. On the other hand, if it were during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, then in that case, the Kohen Gadol did not have to